5 and 2005 UTC right after the international news.
You're watching Straight Talk Africa. I'm Heidi Adams. Hello and welcome. How much do people whose ancestors were brought to the Americas during the Atlantic slave trade know and understand about their African heritage? How present and how absent is that connection to Africa in their cultural memory and daily lives? This week, we'll examine the history and experiences of Africa's diaspora communities in the United States and Latin America. We'll also bring you Elected in America, a VOA special series highlighting the stories of Americans of African descent blazing a trail in U.S. politics. Straight Talk Africa starts now. $140 million. According to the World Bank, that's about the number of people living worldwide in the African diaspora today. That means 140 million different stories and connections to Africa spanning centuries, generations, and dozens of countries around the world. And while some in today's diaspora were born in African countries, millions around the world were not. Colonialism and slavery have made it hard for some to learn about their African roots and ancestry. Important information and stories about their lineage and heritage were not documented and, for the most part, cannot be found in history books. And that's part of what we'll explore today. But we begin with the gripping story of a group of mixed-race women who emigrated from Africa to Europe. They now live in Belgium and are suing that country for crimes against humanity over something very personal and very painful that happened during their childhood in present-day Democratic Republic of Congo, then known as Belgian Congo. And as Henry Ridgewell reports, the case comes as Belgium struggles to reconcile its brutal colonial past.
Lea Tavares Mujinga was born in the Belgian Congo, now the Democratic Republic of Congo, to a white Belgian father and a black Congolese mother. When she was 2 years old, while her father was away, Belgian colonial officials snatched her from her home. Speaking last year, Mujinga described what happened.
They took me away from my mother, who was with me at that time, from my parents' home, to put me in a religious institution in Katende, the Catholic mission of Katende, with the Sisters of Saint-Vincent de Paul, as they did with other children before me. And my elder brother was also kidnapped a year before me.
The state's actions were motivated by race.
If a white man or a white woman marries a black man or a black woman, it was seen as a sin. So the child is considered as a child of prostitution. So that's what we were called, children of sin.
Mujinga said she suffered from malnutrition and still bears the physical and mental scars. Thousands of children were taken away from their African mothers by Belgian authorities. After Congo gained independence in 1960, lawyers say they were abandoned. Mujinga is one of five women, now all in their 70s, who suffered that fate as children and are now suing the Belgian government. They are seeking compensation of $55,000 each, a relatively small amount, because if they lose, the women will have to pay a percentage of that sum to the state. The case has much wider implications, says their lawyer, Michel Hirsch.
Those of mixed race were seen as a threat to the colony, a threat to the colonial system, and also a threat to the supremacy of the white race. And what Belgium, the Belgian state, put in place during colonization was a system to eliminate children.
Lawyers say the Belgian state wanted to prevent interracial unions and make sure the so-called Métis children would not claim a link with Belgium in later life. Belgium officially apologized in 2019 for its role in abducting mixed-race children in its African colonies. But Hirsch says it doesn't go far enough.
The system that was put in place by the Belgian state can be qualified as a crime against humanity because it was a systemic attack against a civilian population, children, children of mixed race. That is to say, for racial reasons. The Belgian state admitted the facts, but never compensated in any way. And today, in court, the Belgian state still refuses to compensate.
The civil court in Brussels is expected to deliver a verdict within 6 weeks. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Now, in this week's show discussion, we're focusing on the countries where the African diaspora population first began, the Americas and the Caribbean. I invited three guests, one from the United States, one from Brazil, and another from Haiti. My guests are of African descent, but they were not born or raised in Africa. Their genetic link to the continent dates back centuries when their ancestors were brought to the Americas as slaves. So what do they know and understand about that history and their connection to Africa? How present and how absent are those ties in their cultural memory and daily lives? Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me. Now, we were born in different countries on different continents, but we all have two things in common. We all have African heritage and ancestry, and we all now live in and around Washington, D.C. Let's get a little more acquainted here with some introductions. Johanna LeBlanc is a national security law and U.S. foreign policy expert, originally from the Caribbean nation of Haiti, but she spent most of her life here in the U.S. and has lived and worked on the African continent as well. Barbara Santos is my colleague here at The Voice of America. She's a multimedia journalist with VOA's Portuguese news service. She's originally from Brazil, and, as she says, a proud Afro-Latina. And Calvin Dark is a proud North Carolinian. He says you can tell that from his accent. He's a global affairs analyst and the co-founder of RC Communications, and he writes about African-American history, including his own family's history here in the United States. A warm welcome to all three of you. And Calvin, I want to start with you. Do African-Americans, and here we are talking about Americans whose ancestors were brought to America as slaves, do they feel a natural connection to the African continent? Is that connection very present in their daily lives? Can you help us understand it?
Yes, I believe there is, but I think it would be a little bit of a stretch to say there's a conscious connection of, say, history, just because we're not taught it. There are a lot of people like myself who, you know, investigated it to see what the connections are. So I wouldn't say that part of the connection is natural, but here's what is natural. I know that no matter what you as an African-American may know about our history, when you see people of the African diaspora around the world struggling with challenges, there is that natural connection. We see there's a common struggle, and the common thread in that struggle is that we're black and brown.
And Johanna, how do you experience that connection, both in Haiti and here in the United States?
Well, for me, that connection is automatic. I've also lived in countries across the African continent, including South Africa, your home country. So for me, I see myself not just as a black woman, but as an African woman, because like my co-panelist said, regardless of where you are from, whether you are right here in America or on the African continent or in the Caribbean or elsewhere, the struggles are the same. We are all fighting against the same systemic oppression. And the sooner that we realize that and the sooner that we unite, the sooner that we can actually make sustainable changes to ensure better economic opportunities for all of children of Africa.
Well, now, of course, Johanna, you are well-traveled. Your work and education have taken you to many places in and outside the United States and also across the African continent. But what is your sense of this connection and what it's like to Africa for ordinary people in Haiti, you know, where about 95% of the country is of African descent?
I would say probably not the older generation, because from the inception of the country, when you had the slave trade to the Republic of Haiti, you had a class system, right? You had the Africans and at the bottom, and the indigenous people of the land were the Tainos at the time, and then you had the French. So that class system created a great deal of discrimination when it comes to Africans. So the older generation, not so much, but the younger generation understand, we connect to the culture, we connect to the continent. In fact, we have a song in my country where when we die, it pretty much says that we're going back to Guinea.
Barbara, take us to Brazil, which was the last country, of course, in Latin America and the Western Hemisphere to abolish slavery. But what I found so fascinating is that in a recent census in that country that showed the majority of Brazilians today identify as being of African or mixed African descent. How do those Brazilians then connect with and understand, you know, the African part of their identity?
Yes, I think that the Brazilian ties with Africa are really strong. Brazilian population is about 45% of the Brazilian population declares itself as Black or of mixed race. But Brazil also is a really complex society because we have the cases of colorism in Brazil because of the mixing of the population. So this identity, racial identity in Brazil is also a complex issue because many light-skinned Black people, for example, they don't consider themselves as Black. And the racial structure in the society gives instruments like the Brazilian blowout for hair, nose jobs, plastic surgeries that Black Brazilians use as a tool, many light-skinned Black Brazilians, to be perceived as white. I think that Brazil still has the strongest ties with Africa. It's the largest Black population after Nigeria in the world. So the Brazilian Black community is strong, is fighting hard for its rights to recover the memory and history with Africa. It's fighting hard. We have advances in legislation. We have one of the most advanced laws against racism in the world. So we have two types of legislation. One is against racism, and there is the racial discrimination or injury that's against one person, that's insults against one person based on race, skin color, gender, and religion as well. And why would we say religion, for example? One of the strongest ties between Brazil and Africa are the Afro-Brazilian religions that to today exist and are respected in the country, but many of those the people that practice this type of religion, they are persecuted by the population, and not only Black people, but Brazilians, white Brazilians that also descend of Africans that through generations got features that are more perceived as white, but cannot practice those religions because, well, it's not well seen in the country.
And some of what you refer to here, Barbara, I've got to say, plays out almost identically in South Africa, especially these parts about race. Johanna, you have lived and worked in my home country of South Africa. You know, it's nothing surprising to encounter this kind of stuff. Even at the airport coming into your country, people want to know your racial makeup before you even open your mouth. Calvin, we live in the era of DNA testing. There's a lot written and a lot on television here in the US about African Americans tracing their heritage and their lineage. Do you find that genetic testing has sparked more of an interest among African Americans to know more about their ancestry here in the United States specifically? Are they also really interested in, their roots in Africa and how their lineage traces back to the continent?
Yes, I think there's definitely a rise in that. And, you know, as an example, 2 weeks ago, I attended and presented at the African American Historical and Genealogical Society virtual conference, and they had hundreds of African Americans there. That's something that we wouldn't have seen, you know, maybe two decades ago. But I think it's happening for two reasons. One is because of the way that slavery was designed to not have a connection with where in Africa those who were enslaved came from, there is this desire to know as much as we can. And so through the DNA testing with the ethnicity variations, that is a step closer. But the second reason why it's useful is I want to know more about the enslavers, because if I know more about the enslavers, I know where my ancestors came from. Because a lot of times in this country, as I think in every country that had slavery, the enslavers were also related because of the sexual exploitation. And, you know, I'm even in a situation where during the DNA testing, I found connections with white people that I grew up with and knew all my life. And so talk about awkward conversations. But I think it's great because it just shows that we have a yearning to know more that was taken away from us as far as our history is concerned.
Johanna, bouncing off what Calvin just said about DNA testing, do you find that there is a desire among Haitians to know more and do more to sort of actively seek out and celebrate their African roots or identity?
Certainly. Just like my co-panelist from Brazil talked about the colorism issue, it's significant in the Republic of Haiti. While the country is probably 95% Black, some would argue even 99% Black, but what you'll see is folks of lighter complexion in particular who came to the country from Lebanon and other parts of the world, they tend to hold on to the power of the wealth. And I do think that those individuals usually don't look to Africa as a source of inspiration, don't connect to the African continent. And I do think that even Haitians of a particular class don't always look to Africa as a source of inspiration, as somewhere that they can connect to, especially, as I said earlier, depending on their age. Now, if you have lived in Africa, you've lived in Haiti, you will see a lot of similarities in terms of our culture, what we eat, how we dress sometimes, the way we talk, our mannerism. And in fact, I will tell you this, as I walk down the streets of Accra, Joburg, Kumasi, Lagos, wherever I may have been across the African continent, I could see a direct reflection of myself, because at the end of the day, that's where we're from, whether one wants to acknowledge it or not. As a Haitian woman, I'm a proud African woman from West Africa.
First, I would just like to comment on something that Calvin said about the project of extermination of our population in Brazil. This process occurred in a way that was the whitening of the population. So by the rape of African women, by the abuse of African families, the project was to whitening that population. And that's why today we have a mixed population that doesn't have any ties with Africa anymore. We don't have the memory, the register of where our population is from. One of the victories of the Afro-Brazilian movement is that there is a law that says that every single kid in Brazil has to study Brazilian Afro-history and culture and African history and culture. The problem is the implementation of that law. The problem is the materials. We don't have materials that were adapted to have this content. People that have access to education and that will become like the top professionals in the country are white. So they don't carry those traditions, they don't carry this history with them, and they don't carry the interest to learn these things. It's really sad what happens in Brazil, because this disconnects our population completely from Africa. One of the things that we still have really strongly that is about culture and it's about food. Our habits are pretty similar to Africa. Our beat, like we have samba, that's the music genre that came from African beat. We have the carnival, that's a celebration that came from Brazilians. One of the main dishes in Brazil is feijoada, that's like the rest of the meat and the beans that were made by slaves, because that was the food that they had access to, and that it's a national dish and everybody's so proud of. This connection with Africa itself, nowadays, I think it's getting stronger day by day by the victories of the movements, Afro-Brazilian movements. They are fighting to have Africa perceived in a different way, because that image of the poverty, hunger in Africa, it still exists in Brazil.
And in your experience, Calvin, how much do Americans really learn about Africa in schools? I mean, how much do you learn about the continent as a child in school here in the United States? And where did you learn what you know today? Did you have to do most of that research yourself?
Yes, this is where I think we as a society have fallen down. Like, I'm going to tell you, fortunately, I grew up in an environment where I was encouraged to seek out the history and, learn more about it. But if I had gone by what I was taught in schools, the only people that wrote a few hundred years ago were people named William Shakespeare. The only people that did art were named Leonardo da Vinci. Like, that is all that I would have learned. And that, unfortunately, is getting worse. Now, I will say that there is a movement to have more of that Black pride. And I think that while that is definitely positive, that is something that is not as widespread as it needs to be. Because I'll tell you, I have received social media messages, for example, when I posted about, you know, my family's African roots or, you know, our history and slavery, that basically said I needed to be more grateful because, you know, I went to a great university. You know, I can speak English well, apparently, as they told me. If that hadn't happened, that being slavery, I would be somewhere in a hut with diseases. Like, I'm not even kidding. That's what he said. That goes to show you that's the perception, and that's in 2021. Now, I'll say for me personally, the first time I went to the continent was when I did my Fulbright in Morocco. It was just such an interesting place to be where being Black or brown was not a deficit, you know? But I was fortunate to have that experience. I'm in the minority of the minority of people that ever have that. And so that's the unfortunate part.
Johanna, what about Haiti? What did you learn about Africa and African history as a child during the time that you spent in that country?
Certainly. I left Haiti at the age of 9, and I can tell you, when I left Haiti, I had not been taught anything about the African continent, nor the plight of African Americans, who they are, the history of America, not once. But what I can tell you is that is by design, right? You divide and you conquer. It is intentional, and that is why those of us who've had the opportunity to be exposed, we have a duty and an obligation to teach other people, right? Because what I do believe is that there is power in unity. If you look at the African continent with 1.2 billion people, and you're looking at outside of the continent, 170 million plus people of African descent, if we could come together and work together, we could change the economic conditions of our respective countries and our personal economic situations. When you look at the Continental Free Trade Agreement, right? Can you imagine if people from the Caribbean or businesses from the Caribbean or African American based businesses were to go to Africa to engage in commerce, right? And to stop looking at the African continent from a humanitarian lens, but rather from an investment lens, from a lens where not only can I create wealth for myself, but I can also help with the development of the African continent and also Caribbean nations.
Barbara, you spoke about all these attempts to instill shame in people for recognizing or claiming their African heritage. How did that play out in school textbooks in Brazil? What are children there taught about the African continent?
So in the school books, history of slavery is a footnote. Usually it was for several generations. It's like a rapid, quick passage about Africans were brought to the continent by Portuguese and were enslaved, period. There's no details to how the process happened. And history of Africa, it's a thin chapter about the continent and poverty and hunger, and that's it. We don't see modern Africa in our books. It is changing thanks to the Afro-Brazilian movement that helped implement this law that is capacitating teachers and professors at universities to learn and teach Brazilian, Afro-Brazilian history and culture and African history and culture. But it is still a work in progress. But in daily life, in the schools, for example, it was really common for me, for example, as a Brazilian with a lighter skin complexion, a Black woman with a lighter skin complexion, that people would say, oh, but you're not that Black, so you're good. As if you're like, you're safe because you are not that Black. Or if you just straighten your hair and do like a nose job, you can get there. As like, you can be promoted to the white race. If being Black was a shame, or you can hide the drop of a black blood that you have, So that was really common. And we're talking about the early 90s. So it was really recent that kids were going through this traumatic experience of having to learn their racial identity and see themselves, but learn also that they should be afraid of who they are or ashamed of who they are. There's still a lot of that in the Brazilian society, and the Brazilian movement is fighting, this Black movement is fighting hard every single day, despite everything that's happening in the country, to make sure that Black Brazilians understand that they have their rights secured and they should fight for it.
Calvin, I always wonder, is there a perception among some African Americans that there could be a potential risk in identifying as being from somewhere else? Bear with me here. Especially in this country where Black Americans have had to fight for equality and for justice and you know, just equal standing in society and for generations. Are there those who might say, look, I'm from here, I'm American first, and saying I'm from somewhere else could have potentially negative consequences for me in my life here, in my identity and my place as an American in the society? Is that a calculation for some at all?
Yes, that's a balancing act that, frankly, I think, you know, I know I'm still learning how to do, because let me tell you, I am really passionate about what I've been able to find about my history, connections with Africa, but I am also very passionate about the fact that my family has been here since at least the late 1600s, and that's just as far back as I've been able to prove. And let me tell you, it is so infuriating sometimes when we have people, particularly in our political discourse, who, you know, are white, and, you know, they talk about people that are Black and brown as immigrants, even people like me. And I want to be like, your family just got here, you know, if you want to compare them to mine. So there's like this duality of connecting with Africa, but also letting people know I am not just as American, but after the Native Americans, that's us, because we've been here for that long. And there is this sense of, you know, a lot of African Americans have issues with the hyphenated title, simply because it seems as if there's a forced connection with Africa, right? I understand that. That is why I do not mind when people call me Black. In some situations, I like to be called Black, especially when it reinforces that when it comes to being American, you're looking at it. You can't get much more American than this.
You know, as someone who is an American citizen and who comes from an African country where I spent a significant part of my life into adulthood, I'm fascinated by what and who constitutes African American in the United States today. Johanna, you're from here, from this country, you're from Haiti, and beyond that, you also are from Africa. What is your sense of the relationship between those whose ancestors came to America during slavery and this wave of African diaspora, basically people whose families and forebears have come here in freedom?
Now, I think this is a great question. But as an immigrant in this country, I can tell you, because of the lack of the teaching of the history of Black people in general here in American schools, and of course in schools in Haiti or across the African continent, there's always been this disconnect, right? And there's always, so for example, growing up in America, from Florida in particular, it was not a good thing to say you're from Haiti. You would get beat up after school by African Americans. We're called all sorts of names, go back to your country, and so forth. So as you get older, you realize that is from pure ignorance, right? And to be frank with you, I'll be honest for a second, there was a level of resentment from when it comes to African Americans because of the way that I was treated and the way that some of my friends were treated from other parts of the world. But thankfully, I attended a historically Black college, and I got to really understand the history of Black people in this country, as well as a better understanding of my history. Then I realized that it's all part of the plan. You divide and you conquer. And in fact, I gain an even better, greater appreciation for African Americans, because but for their struggle, but for the liberation movement led by African Americans in this country, I myself, as a Haitian American woman, would not enjoy the freedoms and the opportunities that I enjoy today.
Barbara, what do Brazilians make of the African American experience through slavery and the civil rights era to today?
So in Brazil, there is this myth of the racial democracy, that because we're mixed, we're equal, we're of all colors, when actually Brazil is one of the most racist countries that exist. At the top of the hierarchy, social hierarchy, there are whites. And then at the bottom of it, the Black Brazilians. So in Brazil, we have the subtle racism, everyday racism, that we see in acts, in the eyes, things that you not always can say because it's not vocal, but you feel it. Brazilians see the Americans as not as mixed as Brazil is. And Brazilians see, in general, the U.S. as a really racist country. But Brazilians, at the same time, they don't look at themselves to understand the racism that happens inside their own country. So it is a problem to the Brazilian population when we try to discuss those things, because it is really easy for a white Brazilian to say, well, but we are a mixed country, we are of all colors. But no, to explain the extent of this violence that we have to face every single day, that may not be obvious for somebody that's white and is not going to experience those things, but for every single Black person in Brazil, we know it. We may not even be able to pointed, but the violence is so subtle and it happens so often that it's there.
Johanna LeBlanc, Barbara Santos and Kelvin Dark, we're going to have to leave it there. But what a fascinating conversation, some of which I am never going to forget, especially the parts about Brazil. That country is clearly on another level, levels that I did not even know about. But thank you so much, all of you, for joining me here on Straight Talk Africa. Great to have you. Here in the United States, Miami, Florida is home to Little Haiti, a tight-knit Haitian community. It is a vibrant, largely Creole-speaking neighborhood steeped in the rich and complex culture of America's Caribbean immigrants. And for every piece of Caribbean tradition you experience here, in the food, the dance, the art, and the clothing, the influence of this neighborhood's African heritage is also visible. Constantine Waltz visited that community for us and asked people there how connected they feel to the African continent.
My name is Falayan Griffiths. My family is from Trinidad and Tobago and Jamaica. Here in Miami, I stay connected to the African culture through dance, history, and culture of the African diaspora.
Black history is African diaspora history, and its connection to Africa has always been a part of my consciousness. I've always felt a part of the, quote, diaspora of Africans. To this day, many, many African Americans know very, very little. But one of the features of the slavery era was to disconnect you from Africa, to disconnect your consciousness from being connected to Africa, to make Africa sound like a bad place to be from, which a lot of African Americans to this day believe.
My name is Renee Along, and I was born in Trinidad and Tobago. I stay connected through African dance. Once I started learning of my African heritage, I felt that I needed to give honor to my ancestors who came through the Middle Passage. looking for information and finding out is a way of keeping them alive for me. You know, it's a very deep thing. It's spiritual and it's physical because, you know, I am the diaspora.
And a big thank you to Constantine Waltz on the streets of Little Haiti in Miami, Florida for us. And we also asked you on social media if you think it is necessary or important for Africa to have a strong relationship with its diaspora communities around the world. And here's what some of you had to say. Ibrahim Kasaja in Dubai in the UAE says, it is very necessary as long as our political environment is stable. We need those people to come and invest in their motherland. The connection is truly necessary. James Frimpong in Ghana says, reunification is paramount for the years of emotional and psychological separation. This will heal the spirit of Africa. The relationship will be beneficial both in Africa and the diaspora if knowledge, experience, and skills are trusted and shared. Caleb Belode in Uganda says, we are brothers, but I am hesitant to build a relationship because most in the diaspora were indoctrinated and twisted to suit the Western narratives. Jerome Hannington in Romania says such communities will remind and teach children born in the diaspora about their culture and traditions in their home countries. They can also support their countries economically with both donations and skilled labor. Jamu Fabas in Uganda says, in African culture, your relationship to your family members and community is more important than your business or living abroad. Blood is thicker than water. Thank you so much for your comments. Really appreciate your input. We're going to take a short break, and when Straight Talk Africa returns, we'll bring you the inspiring stories of Americans of African descent blazing trails in US politics. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back. This week, we're profiling a group of young politicians in the African diaspora who are blazing trails in American politics. Here is our VOA special series, Elected in America.
Hi, my name is Naquita Ricks. I am a Colorado state representative for House District 40. I have learned so many things in my freshman session as a state legislator. I have learned how to pass bills. I have learned, you know, how to conduct myself in the Committee of the Whole. It's been a very fascinating place to learn about, you know, the politics, how laws are passed, serving on the different committees, the Business and Labor Committee, also the Public Health and Behavior Committee that I served on.
We responded to so many earlier this year when the unemployment issue was going on, but now we're getting the results, and that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Hearing about Colorado's problems and coming up with solutions to fix it through these bills has been just so rewarding for us. One out of every 10 persons here in Colorado is an immigrant. Six out of every small businesses here are started by immigrant entrepreneurs like myself.
The state of Colorado, the House of Representatives, convened in the 73rd General Assembly, hereby extends sincere tribute to the immigrants and immigrants' descended families of Colorado in honor of National Immigrant Heritage Month. I offer this tribute as a refugee and the first African immigrant to serve in the Colorado State House.
My own family came to Colorado in 1980 after a bloody military coup in Liberia, West Africa, where I'm from. My mother was held at gunpoint for over 2 hours while my sister and I watched. We didn't know if she was going to live or die in that encounter. And the reason why they were interrogating her was because she was engaged to a government official. When they found him, they dragged him to our driveway along with my mother. And just by the grace of God, she was not taken. After a few days, they had rounded up all 13 ministers of the government and they tied them and shot them by firing squad. Within a couple months of that occurrence, we were able to come to the United States, eventually got here to Aurora, where I live today.
Thank you, Representative Briggs.
And so to stand there in the state house and be representing my district, that moment was just really striking for me. And I, you know, it was just a lot to process. But I think that's what we talk about when we say that we talk about American dream. I think people come from all over the world, escaping famine, war, political unrest, like we did, and they come to seek a better life. And I've been so fortunate to be blessed here in Colorado, not only representing my district, but to start my own business, to raise my daughter, and to be able to contribute to others within my community is a true joy.
So this is Aurora Central High School. This is where I spent 4 years and coming to America, leaving all my friends in Liberia and now having to make new friends.
This school is predominantly immigrant because there's so many people here that are from many different countries. I mean, it's a very, very diverse school. It's one of the most diverse ones within the Aurora Public Schools.
I remember walking in snow my first time. Oh God. We were walking to school and I kept slipping and my friends kept laughing at me. It was just silly, but I didn't have, like, I guess, snow feet at the time. This is my neighborhood that I grew up in.
We lived here for about a year before we moved down the street on East Colfax and Joliet.
My mom had to work so much harder to do everything and start all over. And within 10 years of coming, she died from cancer. So, and my sister and I didn't have a mom, and my father died shortly. You know, so we've gone through a whole lot of stuff, and I try not to dwell there, but I know that they put enough in us to try to make a difference and to go after your dreams. I think we should always dream, always reach for something, always have something that you're going to. I've had lots of traumatic experiences, but there's something on the inside that keeps me going. I'm a person of faith. I keep praying. I fall down. I get up. And I said, never give up. Never give up on your dreams. There's always something. Tomorrow's another day, and the sun will come out. Don't give up on your dreams ever.
My name is Omar Fateh. I'm the state senator for District 62 in South Minneapolis. I was born in Washington, D.C. and raised in Virginia. And on the campaign trail and along with my colleagues, I've been telling them that I'm growing up in an immigrant household, but within the American culture, which is a melting pot of ideas, thoughts, religions, and so on. I think I was best to bridge the gap between the new immigrants as well as the folks that have been here.
I, Omar Fateh, do solemnly swear to support the Constitution of the United States.
I'm blessed to represent a very diverse district in South Minneapolis. It's a lot of working class folks. These are folks that have been really hit really hard this past year with the George Floyd murder, the uprising that followed, but as well as COVID-19, which impacted all of us. I regularly go to Lake Street, which are mostly Latino-owned businesses, and I've made that connection with them to help them understand what resources are out there in COVID and in general. I've built a relationship with folks in Little Earth to understand indigenous issues, but also what they want to prioritize in the upcoming sessions. When we speak to them, we make sure that we understand that they're not a monolith, right? So if you go into Little Earth, you don't assume that everybody has the same idea or thought process. That's just not how it is. So I was fortunate enough to form committees within these different communities so that they can help educate me, but also I take their ideas back to the legislature with me to turn it into action and into bills. So a lot of the bills that we come up with are actually constituent run and ideas that we brought with us in these meetings.
So we're here at Cranmer Mall, located in South Minneapolis. There are two Somali malls here in South Minneapolis, both in my district. This is one of the areas that was hit hardest by COVID-19. For the first few months during the pandemic, people really struggled. We had businesses here shut down, but they rebounded. They came back. We had our customers continue to come and support these locally owned, immigrant-owned businesses, and they continue to thrive. So they really bounced back from COVID-19.
We have a lot of business owners that are immigrant-owned businesses, specifically within the daycares, child daycares and adult daycares, home care owners, group home owners, and folks that have struggled with the administrative side of the Department of Human Services. One of the things I tried to do is bridge the gap between the immigrant community, but also their government, the commissioners, assistant commissioners. I've had meetings with the departments as well as the business owners so that they can fully understand any policy changes that are coming up. For example, if they've had any issues with their businesses, they can better understand how to function and organize, but also bringing the businesses together so that they get to know one another as well, so that when they're interacting with government, they're united as one voice rather than individual businesses, and that has proven to be successful.
This is George Floyd Square. It is a memorial, a remembrance for George Floyd and the murder that occurred a little over a year ago now. Folks are coming from all over to come pay their respects, look at the memorial, but also come to these black businesses that are over here, the coffee shops, the restaurants, the tea bars. We've seen a massive increase in crime following the murder of George Floyd. And we've seen people attribute that to maybe having less officers or we need more police. Well, that's not the case. We have to remember that because of COVID, a lot of people lost work. A lot of people went on unemployment. A lot of people were struggling to pay rent. And then couple that with the murder of George Floyd, which was a national murder. People saw an innocent black man getting tortured to death for 9 minutes. People took to the streets. They were really upset.
I represent the district in which George Floyd was murdered, and the uprising that followed really hurt a lot of folks, both the protesters but also business owners. I'm hoping to continue the good work that our office as well as our colleagues have done here. So making sure that we prioritize public safety, making sure that we're investing in affordable housing and public housing so that we're not pricing out our residents and we're preserving our diversity, and making sure that we have a single-payer healthcare system that's not tied to employment so that we make sure that healthcare is fundamentally a human right.
My name is State Representative Esther Agbaje. I represent House District 59B, which covers downtown Minneapolis and parts of North Minneapolis. It's a pretty vibrant district. It's got diversity in its economic classes, and it's got diversity in its ethnic groups and racial groups. And it's really just a fun place to live, and I'm really happy to be their representative. My parents came to the United States in the 1980s. They both immigrated from Nigeria, and they both actually came to Minnesota to attend the University of Minnesota, which is where they met. I have always had jobs that were in this space of helping people or ensuring that people had the resources they needed to do something better for themselves. So one thing that I was interested in was how do we help more people at once? Often that means going to a lever of government. So that was why I was always keen on the idea of running for office. The opportunity arose for the 2020 cycle, and I jumped at it.
I was born and raised right here in Minnesota, and I am passionate about representing 59B because I want to build the most inclusive district in our state.
Very big difference between campaigning and legislating. When you're campaigning, you're very full of ideas and you're full of hope and you're full of vision, which stays with you once you start legislating. But there becomes now, in Minnesota, we have a total of 201 legislators between our House of Representatives and our Senate. And so you are just one of 200 other people that you have to convince to be able to bring your idea and your constituents' ideas into fruition to create policy and change. So there's much more negotiating once you become a legislator.
The member from Hennepin, Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Speaker and members. This pandemic has exacerbated the problems that we have in housing. And this bill, though not everything we want, will mitigate kind of the worst of those problems, particularly for people who have lost their jobs and cannot afford the rent.
A lot of people talk about the pandemic, saying the pandemic showed the inequalities and inequities in our society. All the pandemic did was just shine a brighter light on them. We have been dealing with a housing crisis in Minnesota for years. And that is one of the things that I actually want the state of Minnesota to be bold and step forward on. How do we provide dignified, adequate housing for all members of our society?
Well, I think about all the work you've done on housing in particular, just being able to see it all the way through from the perspective you have is so valuable. Because without that, we're not going to get the solutions that people actually need.
Mm-hmm. You know, me and a couple of other legislators have released statements that have gone against the grain of the traditional DFL leadership. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think we need all of those perspectives. So that way we're getting a real sense of what real people are dealing with. And so I think as we get more people who are, you know, people oriented, justice focused, I think that that means we can do a lot more better work for the state of Minnesota.
Hands up! Hands up! Hands up! Let's go!
I think across the world, there are people who with less means, so less money, maybe people in marginalized groups in their countries who are, as they have been, standing up. I think 2020 was a big year for that, particularly with the pandemic. I think the movement in Nigeria is young people were rising up, standing up against to want a government to work for them. So I applaud their efforts. I think same with young people across the United States and across the world who are standing up and saying, you know, our rights count for something. I wholeheartedly, you know, agree with them and want them to succeed in their efforts. And I, as a young person here who is in a seat of decision making, am also working to make sure that we are doing the work to support everyday working people. As a legislator, it's definitely eye-opening to see the challenges, but also the opportunities across the state of Minnesota. And I think that many of my fellow legislators or decision makers, especially those with immigrant backgrounds, can also see those same challenges and opportunities. And we welcome collaboration with anyone.
My name is Sam Obalde. I'm the first Gambian American elected to Wisconsin State Legislature. I came to Wisconsin almost about 21 years ago. It was December of 99 was when I immigrated basically to the United States. I would call Madison my home all my American life. I've lived here. I seek political office in Madison for many reasons, from race relations to just services that usually local government would provide to their constituent and was not happening. Housing for communities of color particularly was very bad. Wisconsin ranks, I think, worst or second worst in the whole of this country. So those statistics and some of the inequalities was really what triggered me to consider running for office. It was in 2020 that this opportunity came for me to run for state assembly. And I think the diversity and my record at the city council really spoke to my community as to whether or not I can serve them well at the state level. Generally, the way I reach out to my community is I do have coffee out there in the community, what I would call listening sessions for my constituent members. And, you know, in many cases, in fact, it's people who do not look like me in terms of skin color who comes to this meeting and express their concerns and things like that, or issues that they are faced with. What is it that you are challenged with? What is it that you would like to see me go after before my time ends or my mandate with you ends?
My son is 10. He has ADHD, a sensory processing disorder, a mood and adjustment disorder, and what's called disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. I have been the biggest advocate for him, but I have had the hardest time finding resources.
You can
put your name
here.
Absolutely.
More meetings with you and maybe...
And so those interactions have been very, very good. You know, when I was elected, I was the first Muslim ever to be elected at the city council, the first African immigrant to be in the council. But by the time I left, we have two Muslims to be elected, one of them a female. I think I measure my success through giving access to my community, but also at least having some of my community members be part of city and local government. Thank you to all of you for being here. Thank you also for believing in me and supporting me and voting for me and just being part of my life journey. I'm very appreciative of all that. What we will do after every election, all the elections that I've run, is to organize kind of a thank you get together for our community members, both for my district, but also the, you know, the immigrant community, particularly to stop by and socialize so I can hear from them, but also say thank you to all of them. As you can see also, I have some elected officials, but also leaders in the community up here to say something, but also my beautiful wife here, Fadu Jao. Yeah. So obviously without her, I couldn't have been here. Yeah. Me and my wife met maybe about 13 years ago when I was visiting the village at Gambia.
Was that the happiest day of your life?
Yes, that was the happiest day.
She's been very supportive, which is excellent. Without her giving me peace of mind coming home, I couldn't take it this far. So I'm very appreciative of that. I just visited Gambia. Part of that visit was to visit family members.
Assalamu alaikum.
So I traveled to the village where I grew up, Choya. As part of that visit, obviously, it was a traditional welcome. They met, you know, with us, the entourage, I would call it. And then we're drumming and dancing and just, you know, welcome home and things like that. And so the highlight of my trip, obviously, is my mom and the family that I met. But also the fact that I was able to meet the president of the Republic of the Gambia, spend over 2 hours with him, get invited to lunch. To me, that is very special and humbling, and but something that I'll remember for a very long time. But also seeing, you know, many of the now grown up that I started school with who never wanted to go to school. I personally forced my way into school to see them where they are now and just to chat about our childhood and how I took a different path from what they were interested in. Was really also another reminder of how every encounter you can count towards the person you end up being in life.
A set of inspiring stories there produced by VOA's Betty Ayoub. Be sure to join me for the next Straight Talk Africa as we look at coup d'etats in Africa. Experts say globally 2021 was a bumper year for coups. From Sudan and Chad, Guinea, Mali and Tunisia, we'll look at the causes and consequences of the latest series of takeovers and attempted coups in African countries. Join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa. And that is where we will leave it for this week. Thank you to all my guests and all my VOA colleagues who contributed to this week's show. And a big thank you to you for always watching and always listening. Until next time, goodbye.